This is a CKTZ News update. The construction phase of the Dillon Creek Wetlands Restoration Project in what is now known as Linnea Farm ended on Friday, August 20th. Project manager Miranda Cross says,
"It looks like someone put a stick of dynamite in the middle of the field and blew it up. I admit that. But it's actually a well thought out, designed, and we used a lot of different techniques in the construction of the wetlands."
For the past 2 years, a team of experts has been planning to reverse the damages that late 19th and early 20th century human farming techniques wreaked on the creek's ecosystem. Wetlands are a natural filter that holds back most of the sediment, as well as human and animal nutrients, streams would otherwise deposit into lakes. Cross says that one of the consequences of removing the wetland from Linnea Farm was that Dillon Creek contributed to the 2014 algae bloom in Gunflint and Hague Lakes.
"The algal blooms in the lakes are a sign of a long-term ongoing issue, which we're still doing monitoring and research and collecting data, but this erosion that's happening in Dillon Creek, because Dillon Creek has been ditched and channeled and moved, we're seeing massive erosion events upstream. And we've had the chance to look around up there and are starting to work on designing and planning for future projects to address erosion issues that are happening upstream. And these first field wetlands, I hope, will be a first step in addressing what's been happening, but really are a band-aid on a giant wound. It's like coming in and doing emergency surgery as a first step to try and help mitigate the nutrients, and also as an education piece for the community that there's still an issue there, and it's not unique to Dillon Creek. Many people have gardens and livestock, and all the roads have ditches. What I've observed is that this is an issue that's happening at almost every single inlet to the lakes. All around the lakes, we have this silty, sandy soil. It's highly erodible. And anytime we're getting these rain events, we're seeing erosion at pretty much every single inlet. So it's an ongoing project, and there's plenty of opportunity around the lake where we can try and create wetlands that will capture and store the sediment and the nutrients that are flowing into the lake. Linnea Farm is the biggest farm. Well, I don't know if Blue Jay is now bigger, but it's the biggest farm and it's the oldest farm on Cortez Island. So it's a logical place to start, as well as their dedication and willingness in environmental education and stewardship of the land. So it was a great partnership between Linnea and Foci to initiate this project. And because Linnea has so much community engagement and involvement in their education role, the first field sites that were chosen, one, they were wet fields. And so that indicates that likely they were wetlands in the past. And also, they're very marginal farmland. The cows get in there maybe 2 weeks a year when it's dry enough. But they were mainly growing juncus, which is rush, which is a wet plant, and the cows don't eat it. So marginal farmland, very marginal habitat. And also, the first field sites are right along that access road that connects to Quas Park Trails. And so there's a high visibility for the public there in terms of education in this first project. Think that the fields at Linnea used to be a series of cedar swamps and beaver ponds and a braided network of channels and streams that would have flown out across the entire floodplain of what you see as the fields today. And to make the fields, you know, in 1887, the Mansons preempted that land at Linnea and started creating fields. And so, you know, in the early 1900s and the 1800s, they would have moved the stream, which and ditched it and channeled it and put it at the base of the hill, which is what we call Dillon Creek today. And there are ditches on either side of the field and then also cutting across. And the other thing we discovered when we were digging these wetlands is they also used wooden subsurface drains. They used split cedar rails and they placed them down the center or the low spots in the old stream channels. In some places, we found these buried wooden drains that were surrounded by a sandy, gravelly substrate. And so that functions and still was continuing to function today to draw water subsurfacely down and out of the wet areas. And whatever they dug from the ditches, they would have filled the wetlands to try and level the fields. But we could tell that we were still working in a basin. And so what we were looking at is, where was that rim of the basin? If you think about a cereal bowl, where is that rim of the basin and where has it been cut through? Right here. And so we were trying to repair the rim of that basin so that we could hold the water level on the landscape. And when we do that, we give the water a chance to inject the water back into the landscape rather than running it off as quickly as possible. Ditches are designed to move water as quickly as possible off the landscape. And what we're trying to do is hold the water in the soils, in the landscape. And that when we do that, and we bring the water into the wetlands from Dillon Creek, that's when we get the sediments and the nutrients that settle out. When you have high velocity water moving into slow water, then you see a settling of particles, and then the vegetation and the microbes that live in the upper soil layers in the wetland are treating the nutrients. And you know, there's, especially with the wetland vegetation, it's really important for nutrient mitigation. And you get like a biological film of microbes that grow and live around the surface of the submerged vegetation. And that's where you get a lot of nutrient treatment. And so, yes, we get the nutrient treatment and the filtration effect of water moving through the wetlands and the slowing of the water, recharging the groundwater, and also sequestering carbon, and also so cleaning the water, sequestering carbon, creating a natural fire break, which is, you know, this year we're really seeing the dangers of fire and the risk and the threats that posing to many communities.
Cross explained how the water from Dillon Creek will enter the wetlands.
We set the elevation of the inlet 30 centimeters above the water elevation in August, which is low. The lowest water elevation we'll find all year. So every time we get a storm or a rain event, the elevation in the creek rises and it will flow partially into the wetlands. Now, it's not a complete diversion because one thing I wanted to talk about was the stream is a ditch. Okay, so because the stream is a ditch and it's been moved and it's been channelized, the shear stress, which is, you know, a function of the depth of the water and the width of the channel, the shear stress on the sides of the channel are very, very high. And when we get a big rain event, there's nowhere for the water to go but down the channel. And so it raises up the banks and it erodes the banks. The soils in that valley, in the upper soils, are a glacial till, which is a silty, sandy soil, and it's highly erodible. So every time we get a big storm event, and I've observed this because I used to live across the street and walk over that bridge over Dillon Creek every day, pretty much. When we get a big storm event, the waters in the creek become cloudy with sediment. And Autumn, who you've also interviewed, Autumn Barrett Morgan, who's the monitoring technician for the project, she's also observed clouds of sediment after a big rain event flushing into the lake when she was in a canoe doing some water monitoring work. So we know this is a big problem, and that's something I'd like to speak more to also. But let's stick with how the wetlands work. So we get a big storm event. Now we built this inlet. It's 6 meters wide where it connects to the creek. And the creek or the ditch is about 2 to 3 meters wide in its existing path. And we also built this inlet at a 2% grade, which is a very gentle slope going down, and it actually widens out. So at the where it connects, it's 6 meters, and where it meets the wetland is about 11 meters, and it's over a 22 meter length. And then we've seeded it, and it will grow up to be vegetated. And it'll, you know, when we get that first rain, we're going to be there monitoring for erosion, and if we need to come back with rock, we will. But we're hoping that because we've built it so gently and it's so wide, and the shear stresses will be lower, we won't see erosion. And the other thing we've done is we've sloped back the banks of the inlet. So the banks of Dillon Ditch or Dillon Creek are from 1 to 3 meters high and vertical, pretty much along the length of the ditch. And in the wetlands and in natural streams, the banks slope back. And so when there is a flashy storm event, the creek and the water has access to the floodplain. And rather than eroding it, it spreads out over the landscape. And then the water will come in. It's about a meter, like 1.3 meters deep in the center at full water. And you may have noticed some pink flags when you were visiting there. So we've marked the elevation of the water at maximum depth before it will spill out over the spillway around the wetland. And that'll be significant when we're planting. We're going to come back and plant native shrubs and trees in the fall once the rains have come.
Why is the wetland so rough looking and full of sticks, logs, and stumps?
There's two things that make it look really disturbed right now. One is the rough and loosen technique. It tries to recreate a variable microtopography on the landscape. If anyone goes and walks into a swamp, like a big cedar swamp, what you'll notice is there are pits and mounds, there's high spots and low spots. When a big tree falls over, it leaves a depression behind it and it creates a mound where the soil is placed when the roots come up. And that kind of microtopography is really important for habitat for all sorts of different vegetation. It promotes a diversity of vegetation. So in the low spots, you'll get hydric vegetation like sedges and rushes and skunk cabbage. And in the high spots, you'll get western red cedar regenerating or cottonwoods regenerating. And then on the even higher ground, you'll get some of your riparian species and then drier species like Doug fir. So it creates a diversity of habitat for wildlife with the diversity of vegetation that's able to establish. And the other thing that the rough and loosen technique does is it makes the soils loose. You know, with the excavator, they basically pick up a pile of soil and just let it drop back onto the ground. So we're loosening compaction in the soil. And Linnea does a lot with their rotational grazing to reduce compaction, but equipment like tractors and heavy equipment driving over the land and cows, you know, they're heavy animals and their hooves compact the soil. And so the rough and loosen technique is alleviating that compaction in the soil. And any gardener would know a nice loose soil gives a place for the plant's roots to grow and they can go deep and become vigorous, healthy plants. And frogs also love loose soil because the way they get away from predators is they burrow down in the mud. They dive into the mud and they need loose soils to be able to hibernate in and to escape predation. If you go into the forest or into a swamp and into a beaver pond, there's a lot of wood around. And the wood has numerous functions. Primarily, we use it for habitat. Frogs and the fish will hide underneath it, provides cover, provides shade. Turtles and waterfowl will come and loaf on logs to rest or for hunting. Other birds will come and perch. Dragonflies will use it. And in the early years, primarily in the first and second year, the fine branches, the treetops of alder, aspen, or cottonwood, or willow, will also provide egg attachment sites for amphibians and for dragonflies, which can be really important before the vegetation is established. So that's why it looks so messy. Nature is messy, and we're trying to be messy, and we're trying to make, you know, the frogs don't really care what the wetlands look like, but the humans do. And so we try to do our best to make it look natural, and that's pretty hard to do. So we try to make it random and disorganized looking, which is hard to handle when it's not full of water and not vegetated and, you know, the wildlife's not back there yet. In this first year, like we've planted that fall rye on all the exposed soil that we've disturbed. So those will germinate and they'll grow up and green up in the first year and they'll last the winter. They rye overwinters in this climate. We'll get a greening up of the edges and the center where the ponds or the open water will be should stay full for most of the year. That subsurface drainage and the presence of rushes and hydric vegetation, even with subsurface drainage and deep ditches indicates that where we are working was a wetland. And so we're expecting that water will stay around year round. The elevation of water will fluctuate depending on the droughts and the rains. And we saw some pretty extreme drought conditions this year. And it's possible they'll dry, but we expect that the hydro period will be long enough for amphibian breeding to be successful. In the first year, we'll see a little bit of native vegetation. We are going to be planting this fall shrubs. And in the second year, we should see a pretty healthy, diverse native vegetation becoming established, especially with the sedges and rushes and the aquatics. They come in really quickly and the seeds are likely in the soil because we have a drained wetland that we've restored. I was just on a project up in the Kootenays a few weeks ago and we were doing some liner wetlands. And because when we're working during fire risk windows, we need to have fire suppression equipment on site, which is tanks mounted on trucks with hoses. And so the project coordinators on that project decided to fill the wetlands with the water from the fire suppression equipment once we didn't need it anymore. And within a day of filling the wetlands, the dragonflies were coming and they were swooping over looking for bugs to eat. And the deer were coming to drink and the birds were coming. And it's amazing how quickly the wildlife comes back. I've seen frogs and western toads in 1 week old wetlands. They move right in. And we've seen successful breeding of long-toed salamanders and other amphibians in 1 year old ponds. Birds will come in and the ducks, and really quickly it will be vegetated and used by wildlife.
You've been listening to an interview with Miranda Cross, project manager of the Dillon Creek Wetlands Restoration. The Dillon Creek Wetland Restoration Project is a first step. If you would like to support ongoing wetland restoration work around the lakes, send a check payable to Friends of Cortez Island Society, Memo, Wetland Restoration, 2, Friends of Cortez Island Society, Box 278, Manson's Landing, BC, VOP 1KO, Canada, or donate to FOCI online. Donations of any size are very welcome and much appreciated.